On to item five, presentation from CIO and Barris. The Tim and Ed Show.
So we are coming to you with a conversation about our asset allocation targets. We've agreed to take an annual look at these and make small tweaks, depending on A, the size of the liquidity program based upon the actuarial projections, and then B, allocating the remainder according to where we see the best opportunity set. So I've got a memo in your board packet about the sizing of the liquidity program. I'll step through that briefly, and I'll turn it over to Ed to talk about where their capital market assumptions are leading them to want to overweight or underweight relative to last year's targets. So the memo on the sizing of the liquidity program, basically, just as a reminder here, we target 4 years of liquidity payments. We fill that up every July with the employer prepayments. That goes into runoff mode for 12 months. Next July comes around, we fill it back up to the four-year mark. And we fill it up with four-year mark based upon actuarial projections. So this year, when we look out into the future for our expected needs in July, we come up with a target of about $504 million, and that's based upon the actuarial projections discounted at the current yield of the liquidity program, so discounted at about 2%. We are expecting that money to come from a variety of sources, including the employer prepayments and generalized rebalancing in mid-year here. When we translate that dollar amount back into a percentage term, we come up with about 23% of the projected July balance. Now, obviously, we know there's not a lot of accuracy and precision built into that, but it's our best guess, so we have round numbers to start working off of here. And that's really just saying, you know, the projected cash flows over the next several months to get us to July, a ballpark of where we expect the employer prepayments to be, and, you know, what do you think that's going to look like there. So it is that 23%, which leaves the remaining 77% to be allocated across growth and diversifying. This is going to get fine-tuned as we come up to the annual funding plan in June. This is kind of your first pass, rough guidance here. We'll have another take a look at this in June with the annual funding plan and do the fine-tuning there. But that, for asset allocation planning purposes, that's kind of what we're targeting there. Any questions about the sizing of the liquidity program?
I will make the comment that as hopefully our assets grow in size, this is something that over the years we might be coming back to you and seeing a further reduction in that percent, just because, okay, you know, because the dollar amount of the future benefit payments for the 4 years is going to be a certain dollar amount, and obviously as our assets grow, it's going to be a smaller percent.
Right. So. Yeah, so you'll notice that last year was 27% and this year is 23%. We're not reducing the dollars dedicated to the liquidity program. It's simply that we've had the growth and everything else. So the dollars we do need are smaller in percentage terms.
This is sort of a curiosity question on projecting, actuarially projecting, technically the way you'd look at it, I think, is you look at a probability of retirement for those either in the early retirement time frame or approaching it, and we'll reach it within the next 4 years. And then you apply the probability and come up with a small fraction, and you add all those together, and they give you an equivalent. Do they go through all that, or is it, you know, in the past we've had X percent of those eligible retiring, and
it's based upon past experience. So as I understand it, and obviously Siegel can speak to this in a lot more detail than I can, but they're taking a look at everybody who's currently in retirement status and their projected COLA growth. Adjusted for mortality tables and with a probability of new entrants coming in. And it's relatively accurate. So we've been using this for a year now. We've been within $1 to $2 million most months in terms of, you know, where the actual projections were versus what we've actually experienced. We did determine that we were running a little bit high, that the actual projections were high relative to our experience last year, and we've adjusted the model down slightly. But, I mean, we've been projecting something on the order of $36 million a month and experiencing like $34 million a month. So it's pretty darn close here. And so when we take a look and down into the future, Obviously, the further you project, the less accuracy and precision you're going to have in that figure, but we feel pretty confident that this is a good working model that we refine over time.
That's a good test.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a recommendation under expected allocations, and I don't have a particular number in mind. I'm just wondering, the recommendation is to increase the allocations for emerging markets and international by 1%.
We'll get to that next.
Oh, next. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you were done with that.
Pages dedicated.
I'll hold that thought.
Okay. All right, so liquidity program is done. Everything else can be allocated across growth and diversifying, and that's Ed's realm here.
Great. Thank you, Tim. Morning, everyone.
Morning.
I'll be referring to the printed materials we have here. I think it's next in your binder. So first, just want to start with the executive summary on page 3. Quick review of why we do this. So just in terms of, this is our annual review of the FFP, primarily driven by the recognized need to resize the liquidity portfolio, but then also gives us an opportunity to update our views on the capital market assumptions and how that might impact how we construct the growth and risk diversifying portfolios. And so then the takeaways that we have here, points 1 through 4, based on this year's review, as Tim mentioned, resizing liquidity. So we check that box. We're going to talk about decreasing the size of the risk diversifying portfolio as we've scrubbed that portion better. And I'll share with you what we've talked about in the past, what we've done additional research on, and why that leads us to believe that the adjustment from 12 to 10% is appropriate and prudent. The third point, recategorizing risk parity. We'll talk about some of the more additional research we've done there and why that categorization is recommended. And then finally, adopting MIX2. And then if approved, these allocations will factor into the long-term targets and we'll develop a revised implementation program. Skipping ahead to page 5 is basically the math behind what Tim just talked about. So the bottom line there showing the 22.9% is the rounded 23% that we're using for the liquidity portfolio. And then turning to page 7, we get into the risk diversifying sub-portfolio. So here, this first bullet point, the role of the risk diversifying portfolio is allow us to rebalance. In fact, allowing staff to rebalance during times of market corrections to capture declines in the growth portfolio and saying, hey, when we've seen that before, we've had to suffer through it. Next time it happens, we want to be able to be a provider of liquidity and buy into that so we can enjoy more of the upside. Second point is that, and this is really where the additional research comes into play, we have these three concepts. We want the portfolio to be highly liquid. We want it to have positive returns and low correlation. And if we think about those three things, we could first think about U.S. Treasuries as an example. Highly liquid, yes, they trade daily. Positive returns, yes, modest, somewhere in the 2 to 3% range given today's yield curve structure. So positive but modest returns. And low correlation. And historically, bonds have shown low correlation to growth portfolio. There are times when those correlations work better than others, as correlations are not static. They change through market conditions. But it kind of checks all those boxes. So U.S. Treasuries are a good example. But as we started to scrub this more and say, what else is out there? What can we do that's better, smarter? Is there anything else? And in conducting the RFI and saying, what's the free world have? Show us what you've got. We scrubbed that some more and we said, highly liquid to us now means something between daily liquid and within 1 month. We want to be able to rebalance basically within that time frame. We don't want quarterly or annual kinds of lockups. So that kind of takes, you know, private equity, private credit kinds of strategies off the table. It really constrains the world of hedge funds. Some of them have longer lockup periods. It really forces the discipline about we want high liquidity because we want to be able to move when we want to be able to move. Positive returns, we're basically saying there, something better than treasuries. So if treasuries are giving us 2 to 3, great. What else is out there that's higher? So if we can find something that's 4, 5, or 6, show it. And low correlation is really a key point because when we look at correlations in portfolio construction, anything less than a 1 correlation is beneficial to a portfolio from a diversification perspective. If you have something that's perfectly correlated with something else, adding it to your portfolio doesn't do anything. If it's less than 1, it's additive from a risk return perspective. And if you really push that down the spectrum, what you really want is something that has a 0 correlation so that whenever they interact, there's really no relationship between one going up and the other going down, that they behave independently of each other. And 0 is actually even better than negative. Negative, we know that when one goes up, the other one goes down. So we really started to hone in on 0 correlation. That's going to come back to how we think about risk parity and why we're recommending a change in the thought process on risk parity. So I'm going to come back to that. But just reviewing those three goals, highly liquid is kind of a day to a month kind of time frame, roughly speaking. Positive returns greater than treasuries, low correlations, targeting zero if we can find it. The third bullet point is introducing a concept of how we think about sizing the portfolio. So we're recommending decreasing the size from 12% to 10. And here's why. It's because when we look at the volatility within our portfolio, we really want to understand how the growth portion works, and particularly how the publicly traded growth portion works. Because when we're developing the private markets program, we're making a commitment to that long term. So we're not looking at the private markets as a place to rebalance into or out of. We're building that program with long-term expectations, and we're going to have to ride out the waves, okay? But the public markets trade daily, and that's where we want to be able to say that if there is a correction, we want to be able to buy into that. So we started to focus more on what does the publicly traded growth portion of the sub-portfolio look like. And then the last bullet point, this is one component of how we can react to a market correction. The board retains the ability, as codified in the investment policy statement, to look at the liquidity portfolio as an additional source. So if we really have a major market correction, you all could just say, hey, you know what, let's reduce from 48 months of benefit payments captured in the liquidity portfolio. We can reduce that to essentially down to 24. And take those assets and buy into the growth portfolio. So that's already part of your IPS. And that's something that we would use under extreme market conditions, a la 2008 kind of correction. So you have that additional. So you have kind of a tiering. You have a diversified portfolio. You have dynamic rebalancing within it. You have the risk diversifying portfolio. When you have a market correction, you can take advantage of that. And when it's a major market correction, you can turn to the liquidity sub-portfolio. Does that all make sense?
But I don't remember us ever discussing being able to lower that from 48 to 24 months in case of emergency. That was in the memos and the policies that we developed?
That is a board-owned decision. So from the staff rebalancing perspective, we basically vary from the 48 to 36, and that's pretty mechanical. So every year we fill it back up to 48, we draw it down to 36. That is what's under the purview of staff. In an extraordinary environment, the board retains the ability to take a vote, and if you so choose, to reduce that down to 24.
All right.
But that's as Ed said, like, that's extreme. Under quote unquote normal variations, we don't anticipate doing that, but the board retains the ability.
It's a little bit unusual the last couple of weeks, though. That's
Relative to long-term history, not that unusual, but relative to the past couple of years of no volatility, yeah, it's getting a reintroduction to volatility.
Yeah.
And to answer your question specifically, yes, it is in your IPS today, so the language is in there, spelled out with the 24 and 48 months.
Yeah. Jerry, Ed and Tim are going to let us know whether or not to buy or sell. At the end of the meeting.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Text notification.
Don't right. Make me laugh. I'll start coughing.
Great. So I'd like to come back to page 8 in a moment. I'd like to skip ahead to page 9, following on this logic of how we size the risk diversifying portfolio. Page 9 just has a schedule showing where the liquid and illiquid assets are. So we're considering the value add and opportunistic real estate, private equity, and private credit as illiquid assets. So we're really paying attention to the liquidity side of this, the liquid side of this. And if you turn to page 10, here's the math behind it. So what we did in this table, we are showing the allocations to each of the publicly traded portions of the growth sub-portfolio. So U.S. large, for example, and its allocation, international developed, REITs, EM, and risk parity, total 34%. And so what we did was we said, okay, that's 34% of our current portfolio. If we scaled it in a way where that was the entire portfolio, we can then model it with using our asset allocation software, which is what we show on the right-hand side. So proportionately, those are the weights there. So they total 100%. We take that portfolio and we start to model it. We say, okay, what does a fifth percentile return look like in our modeling software? How bad is a fifth percentile, a 1 in 20 year kind of event look like? And it's a 21% drawdown. So we said, okay, 21% drawdown, that gives us some indication then. If that portion of our portfolio decreased by 21%, and that portion of our portfolio is 34% of our total portfolio, 21% drawdown against 34%, our total portfolio decreases by 7%. So that gives us guidance then, saying if that happened, and we have this 7% impact, we want our risk diversifying portfolio to be at least that large so that we can now capitalize on the opportunity. So we said 7% would be the lower boundary. And so then we just kind of did some rough math and said, well, that's you know, certain conditions, that's fifth percentile. If that happens, we should probably cushion it a bit. And that's how we got from 7 to 10. So the 7 to 10 doesn't have a lot of science behind it, just kind of round numbers felt good. That gives us the cushion that we want. For modeling purposes, you know, getting to a 9 or an 8 isn't going to change much. So we said 10 is probably a good place to land. And so that's the recommendation there. Let me pause, because I know talking through a lot of math, that can get kind of mind-numbing in a way. But let me see if anyone has any questions on that.
I was told there would be no math.
You let me know who that person is.
Sorry, Scott.
Ed, we're going from 12
Sorry,
to 10.
12 to 10. And then back to page 8 is the risk parity research that we did. So back in May, almost a year ago, the board authorized a search for risk parity managers with the idea that it would be a contributing piece of the risk diversifying portfolio. And this first bullet point is key in that as we did additional research, both Veris and staff, liking what they're showing in terms of attractive risk return characteristics, like the approach to actively managing volatility, those can both be additive pieces of the portfolio, so we like that. But the second bullet point is really the sticking point where we saw the correlations are in a range of 0.4 to 0.8 with a median of about 0.6, so they aren't quite as uncorrelated as we were hoping. Yeah. So when we say let's put it in the risk diversifying portfolio, it's like, yeah, except that it has this correlation thing. And if we can do better, let's do better. And you know, actually that leads us to last month's discussion about parametric and how that strategy fits in, much lower correlation. So it kind of ticks that box. So continuing on then, we like what's going on there. We think it's a better fit in the growth portfolio. And so we just kind of recategorized it there and said, yeah, let's see if we can move that 5% allocation.
And it's certainly something that fits in between those two roles there, the long-term growth, the downside risk mitigation, and a more moderate volatility profile. But I think the thing that, at least from the staff perspective, where we got a little bit hung up on this was the correlation in a downside event. So the correlation between risk parity and broad liquid stock market when this broad stock market was selling off. And we thought that correlation was just too high to be able to rebalance it without having the permanent impairment of capital there. So we didn't want to be selling risk parity when it's off, you know, half as much as the broad stock market. That's not as powerful of a trade as a something that's going to hold up, be down, be flat, or down slightly.
I just wanted, at this point, I wanted to just comment on the process, because some trustees might think, oh, May 2017, we authorized a search, what's going on with that? Last year, the board authorized the issuance of a RFI, a request for information. Risk parity is a new space for Cicera. As you know, we haven't invested with risk parity before, so we felt it was important to kind of see what's out in the market, analyze it, take a deeper dive into it. So the result of that RFI were a number of firms that responded with information. You know, Veris and staff looked closer at it, and this is kind of the culmination of all those activities. So I just wanted to comment on that. It wasn't an RFP. It wasn't, you know, there was no award or anything. It was an RFI because we knew that we wanted to get more information about what was in the market.
There was a very long research process, including a number of on-sites and pretty heavy review, but yeah, we want to get this right.
It's been a very thoughtful process, especially being something brand new for us. We didn't want to just have a knee-jerk response and get into something. So I wanted to mention that.
Good. Then let's jump ahead to the proposed mixes on pages 12 and 13. So here we're showing the current portfolio where we have the assets currently positioned or as of December 31st. Phase two phase 2A targets, so the interim target, then the long-term target, and that's really what we're talking about making adjustments to, is the long-term target.
Thank you.
And we're proposing AltMix 2 as the new solution here. And so just as you compare through the asset allocation, you're going to see 1% differences here and there, not much, which is actually pretty good. That's kind of what we're hoping for. We want some stability in the portfolio allocations. We don't want to be completely rebalancing the portfolio every year just as a result of this process. So this is actually pretty good news. We have the differences primarily driven by the short-term gov credit going from 27 to 23%. And as a result, a couple other movements. And then we have the risk diversifying down at the bottom. This looks like it's going from 7% to 10%, but the 7% is because risk parity has now been moved up to the growth portfolio, so the 5 went up there. And then on page 13, you see the results of the modeling. Take this for what it's worth. Long-term target going from 6.5% with our 2018 capital market assumptions to AltMix 2 at 6.6. So let's say those are about equal. Standard deviation going from 10.4 with the long-term target to 10.7. Again, about equal. And the other numbers follow suit. So really minor differences in terms of both the weightings and the outcomes for the portfolio. The next several pages.
Which gets, I think, to the question I was going to raise before, if I could. I'm wondering, I don't have a number in mind, but all the stuff I read and hear, some of the meetings I've attending, basically suggesting that the international marketplace is in very good shape and growing and looking good with certain exceptions. So I'm wondering whether or not you think, it sounds like you do, that slight increase in international developed and emerging markets is adequate, or whether or not we may be missing some of the wave that's possibly out there. Mm. Is it too modest?
So great question. We are doing this modeling work based on what we're showing on the right-hand side in terms of the returns and standard deviations. And so those are 10-year forecasts. So we're trying to think about it longer term in terms of, you know, alignment with the objectives of the pension plan for that modeling and portfolio construction purpose. I think what you're hitting on is an important piece when we think about tactical positioning or tilting, and we say, okay, if we set these as the targets, what are our operating ranges around those? Can we go plus or minus 2% or plus or minus 5%, and how do we want to capitalize on that kind of opportunity? So that then would get incorporated into the IPS with the ranges around it. Do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the things that we have in the lineup that allows us to take advantage of those tilts in there is our global equity mandates, where they can lean into the international markets, they can lean into the U.S. markets, and so we can gather some additional information from them. We haven't seen them go whole hog up against their target allocations. I think they trying to remember the individual terms, and I can certainly look them up and come back to you, but you know, I think we've seen them lean into the non-U.S. exposure. Certainly anybody who has a valuation tilt is leaning out of the U.S. exposure at this point in time. But you know, with the mandates, the flexible mandates we have with the global equity managers, they can lean one way or the other, and we can get a little bit more of that tactical tilt in through those.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah. The returns you have listed for the different asset classes on line 12, and then for the different scenarios on 13, are those real or nominal?
Nominal. These are all nominal. So our inflations are built using an inflation expectation of 2.1% over 10.
So Ben, am I right in noticing that all the options you have for the 10-year return are lower than the discount rate for the plan?
Yes, but we'd have to adjust that for the higher inflation target used by the actuary as well. So
and
I think
in the time frame.
So I think we tend to focus on what is the real expected return that's embedded in the actuarial assumption. And I'm trying to remember Siegel's inflation target. It's typically run higher. I know they've brought
it's
down.
Been like three.
But they brought it down recently. But you know, I think a 4% real is the typical shorthand there. And you know, you are correct in noting that nothing here approaches the 7%. Nothing hits the 7% actuarial assumed rate of return. But I think, you know, as Ed said, you know, you have the differential in time frame. If this is over 10 years, the actuaries tend to project over 30 years. And I think we want to be careful that we are taking a look at the real rates of return. And I think we're still in that 4-4.5% range.
I think we went to 2.75, didn't we, on inflation?
I'd want to go back and double check because that's just not front of mind. But it's been historically the actuaries have had a higher inflation target built in there, largely because they're taking a look at that longer time frame. They'll take a look at that 30-year history with obviously periods of much higher inflation than we've experienced over the past decade.
It was 2.7.
Recalling it in part because it was linked to dropping from 7.25 to 7.
So 4.25% real. Yeah. These would be 4.5% real.
I mean, not to say that any of the numbers are so precise that, you know, a small difference in an inflation adjustment is going to take the number, or even that the estimated number here is I'm sure the great, Ed.
Yeah.
I think one of the basic jobs as a trustee is to determine if, at the asset allocation level, whether kind of that mix is risky enough or maybe too risky. And I think, for one, it'd be great to at least use the same set of assumptions, so just on paper that, you know, looks transparent enough. But two, do you feel that, you know, the mixes that you're recommending are that risky enough to meet the return hurdle for the investment program without getting into kind of maybe there's some pickup from tactical tilts in different line items. Maybe there's some pickup in moving from risk diversifying back into growth when the opportunity's there. But these numbers don't assume any of that, right? Like the 6.6 for alt mix one, that doesn't assume we're going to rotate from the risk diversifying back into growth and have some upside advantage.
Yeah, it assumes that these are your long-term targets and you're not deviating from those. And certainly the operational flexibility that our asset allocation has is not something that's captured in these types of models. So, that's a very accurate observation, Jay. I think it's, you know, I think the flexibility we know has value. It's very difficult to quantify that value other than to say, when we have experienced the dislocations, the ability to be the providers of liquidity has historically been rewarded, and we want to be on that side of the trade. How valuable that is, what's the option value of that, difficult to quantify. And these models don't anticipate any of that, other than being able to rebalance the target.
Yeah, at some point, I think it'd be interesting to see what kind of market moves you would envision moving pieces of the risk diversifying portfolio back into the growth. And, you know, so we have an idea of what kind of triggers there would be for that action. I'm sure you've walked through it when you got everybody on board with FFP in the first place. But I guess back to the basic question then, is this a high enough returning portfolio? I don't know how about all the other trustees or your opinions on that. There could be different mixes that lead to higher expected returns at a corresponding higher risk level. But given the plan's discount rate and kind of return expectations, is this sufficiently risky portfolio?
So let me make sure I understand the question in terms of with a 7% discount rate and a 2.75 inflation assumption built into that, we're looking at a 4.25% real return based on that side of the equation. On this side of the equation, we're looking at a portfolio mix with a 6.5, call it, expected return with a built-in inflation of 2.1, which would lead us to a 4.5% real return. So, you know, and assuming that we're looking at kind of median expected, where we have variability over what the range of outcomes could be, if we're comparing kind of median expected return against the actuarial assumption, you have a higher returning portfolio than what your actuarial assumption is on a real rate.
Yeah, and I think that exact comparison of numbers should be in here somewhere.
Okay.
So it's just kind of laid out for people.
Okay. Know? But being that as it may, I think your question then was, is that risky enough, and do we need a higher returning portfolio? My question would be, why would you want a higher returning portfolio if you're designing your portfolio to meet your actuarial assumption? You're doing it in the most efficient way that you can, given where the capital market assumptions are. Why would you want to assume more risk, and how would you justify that in terms of, you know?
I think one of the justifications that people give is that your return expectation is just your expected return for that distribution. And so you have a 50% chance of making that, you know, or above, 50 or below. And for some plans, that kind of 50-50 bargain is not sufficient, right? I don't know that we have a stated goal of wanting to be more likely to meet the discount rate than not. But I think that's a consideration for people.
It is, and I think when we had this discussion a couple of years ago, one of the things I would caution the board against doing was tying too much of the asset allocation directly to the actuarial discount rate. And this is always a chicken and egg kind of conversation. It's, do you engineer an asset allocation to deliver your actuarial discount rate, or do you set your asset allocation independently and let the actuary come in and then assign a discount rate? And I think, you know, the consistent messaging from the actuarial side of the community has been, we want that to be separate and distinct, and the fact that they're circular is a little bit troubling. So we've tried to separate this and say, let's set our asset allocation based upon where we think the most efficient capital deployment is, based upon, you know, the view of the next 10 years here, and let Siegel come in and give a, you know, a independent view of what they think the actuarial discount rate is going to be. And I think having the ability to have the liquidity reserves set off to the side and being able to deploy the growth kind of where we saw the best opportunity set was the dominant conversation. So if we're able to have the sleep at night comfort of the liquidity program, then we can deploy the growth wherever we think it's most prudent to do so and be able to know that we can stick to our guns and basically not have to sell at the wrong period of time because our benefit payments are reserved over here. And when we've done that in the past, I mean, and we've only gone through this a couple cycles now, the board is able to look at that and say, you know, is this the most prudent deployment of the growth capital? Have we sized everything appropriately? And the actuary can come in and have that independent view. And it's that, you know, I think the dangerous part of tying the asset allocation discussion to the actuarial discount rate is it sometimes pushes you in a risky direction, so that you can have periods of time where certain markets are extended in valuation and therefore have a lower expected future rate of return. It pushes you into the highest risk asset classes, perhaps at the wrong period of time. And, you know, the poster child for this was 2007, when you had diminished expected returns on most asset classes. But if you're still trying to reach your actuarial discount rate, it would lead you to overweight the equity markets, not to take a more realistic view of what you could get from those markets over that shorter period of time.
I think Jay's comment is actually a topic for board discussion. I don't think that's, I mean, we can weigh in. We're happy to field questions or whatever, of course. But I think your point is, or your question is really targeting, like, where is that margin of safety that we want to build in from a return perspective? And in answering that, I think there are some pages back here that take you through scenario analysis, and you can start to think about upside, downside in terms of how this portfolio and the alternatives have behaved in positive economic environments and negative, and you can start to weigh that. But I really think that your question is targeted to board discussion, and let us know. And then we can use that to construct mixes that appropriately meet that objective.
We'll probably schedule that one after the next investment risk presentation. I'm glad you went back to kind of walking through the benefits of the FFP, because I think
anytime we walk through an asset allocation decision, there's a lot of detail there, but the big driver of the planned return is going to be exactly that rotation from liquidity, or the maintaining of liquidity and the rotation from risk diversifying into growth. And so I think it's also important for the board to remember kind of when you signed on to FFP and this construction, you kind of made that implicit decision that, you know, some of these expected returns, they are what they are. Maybe they're lower than the discount rate. Maybe there's some assumption changes or whatever, but it's that kind of liquidity buffer and risk diversifying into growth. That's the whole plan here. There's a lot of detail underlying, but that's the big bargain that everybody made. Right?
Well, but it's a functionally, to me, it's a functionally integrated asset allocation, right? It's not, you can't take one part of it or look at some one section of it in isolation from the others. I mean, the totality of the exercise was to try to develop this functionality to meet the obligations of the system and to provide a reasonable rate of return and reduce the risk inherent in the equity markets. I mean, I think that was the general driver, at least for me, it was. And the more thoughtful matching of our monthly and annual nut in liquidity portfolios to meet those obligations without the necessary drawdown in the larger portfolios on an ongoing basis to meet that. So.
Well, I think we're probably talking about two slightly different aspects of this. I mean, certainly the underpinnings of the FFP were the ability to maintain liquidity to respond to the market as it's presented to us. Now, this exercise is, a little bit different in that we're having to take a look and say, where do we see the opportunity set and is the risk profile, and I think this is what Jay is driving at, where is the risk profile, what's the downside scenario, is that something the board's comfortable with? And that's a conversation we had 3 years ago in the workshop. But probably bears revisiting.
Yeah, it's the old "what is your risk number,"
which is
that's
a challenging discussion, as we discovered last time we had it.
Yeah it is.
Yeah.
And after 3 months of volatility, I might give you a different answer today than I did then.
So just to wrap up this presentation, if that makes sense as a next step, we have several charts showing the asset allocation and risk allocation, and if you go to page 17, you can start to take a look at these historical scenarios.
So on 17, Ed, there's three, but the two major upside scenarios, in the first one, the top one, the spread is... Everyone's pretty packed. There's a huge spread between the first two scenarios and the remaining four in the oil price decline.
Yeah.
What drives that?
Domestic equity. So in our current portfolio, we have 10%, 11% large cap, U.S. large cap, 6.5% U.S. small cap. So, call it 17.5%. And in the long-term target and alt mix 2, that comes down to 5 and 6%. So it's really a U.S.-dominated rally that took place there.
Thank you.
So the 2007-2009 subprime mortgage meltdown here, we can see that those portfolios drawing down 31%, 32%, 26% in some cases. This is the modeling of the current portfolio, again, without assuming any rebalancing or anything else. So that's interesting because we think a lot about with pension plans the ability to play defense, that even when our portfolio is down that much, we still have to make the monthly benefit payment check. How do we do that? In our case, we have the liquidity portion dedicated to doing that, allowing us to recapitalize or take advantage of those opportunities. If we are effective in doing that, we would enjoy greater upside as a result of this. So this doesn't capture the nimbleness of the program, but rather the static allocations. Similarly, in the 72 and 74 decline on page 18, the oil crisis at the bottom, Here we're seeing that the static portfolio allocations actually do play nice defense. This was a U.S. equities-led downturn that hopefully we won't have to relive. So, and then stress tests on page 19 highlight individual points like the U.S. dollar appreciating 20%, global equities correcting 20%, credit spreads widening, and global rates increasing. And we can see the sensitivities there. And you'll notice that the bottom one, global rates rising, is the biggest exposure, I guess you could say, from these point stress tests. And that reflects our short-term positioning in the portfolio, that would have more immediate impact on the valuation of the short-term gov credit portion of our portfolio, which would be the driver of the downside. Now, the saving grace in that is that our portfolio on the short-term gov credit is largely buy and hold, so that we hold these bonds through maturity and they pay off anyhow. So the pricing of them, while important in terms of valuation of the portfolio, is not as critical in the actual payment of benefits. The only thing we're really concerned there is if those bonds were to default. And as long as they don't default, we're in good shape, and that's why it's a high-quality portfolio of high-quality governments and high-quality credits, so that we mitigate that downside exposure. And then the appendix with all sorts of gory details behind it all.
I had a question. You mentioned on tactics. So, I mean, you have things like, let's say there's a tariff goes into China as an example. So how are we reacting, or are you two reacting to those sort of things?
So we have some research that's going to come out. I think you'll first see it probably in our next QIL, but I've seen some of the work that they've been doing behind the scenes on it.
Okay.
And it's pretty interesting because, anytime we hear these headlines, we want to dig into them and say, okay, fine, yeah, that's the headline. Now tell me what's really going on.
Right.
And so it allows us to scrub the numbers. And part of what we did was say, okay, show us all of the trade balances in goods and services around the world between U.S., EU, and China, and show us the balance there, and show us the trade deficits there, and show us the differences between the goods and the services, and show us the tariffs that others are applying to our goods and services versus what we're applying to their goods and services, and guess what? Our tariffs that we're applying to everyone else are lower than what they're applying to our goods and services. Major trade deficit with China. Tariffs applied by China are much higher to our goods than what we're applying to theirs. So you take all that and you say, okay, so what's the real economic impact? Maybe it's not so much trade war as it is a righting of the ship in some respects, depending on how we get there. A second point is that, with regard to tariffs, is that when you exercise a tariff and the corresponding country retaliates, it's a dangerous policy because if you then decide to retract yours or not apply it, do they also back off or do they keep theirs in place? Because you lose control of that side of the equation. So that's something to keep in mind. And the other side, the third point is that as we're now, over a year into the Trump administration and seeing how he negotiates, he'll do something like this to create negotiating leverage for something else and then back off of that.
Okay.
Let's hope that happens because every economist in the free world is saying tariffs are bad. They're just bad. And if you're finding them elsewhere in the world, they should be lower. They shouldn't be higher. This doesn't help anyone. So from the economics perspective, which then translates into the financial markets perspective, lower tariffs are better. And all of this is hopefully noise. If it does become trade war, well, we haven't had a good trade war or good tariff outcome.
There is no good trade war.
Smooth, so well, and so.
So Varys is doing the what if scenarios. That way, we're prepared should something.
Yeah. So if your question is how do we respond in real time, our managers are responding in real time. They're taking a look at this and saying what's the direct impact, what is the impact on the viability of the companies we're investing in, their stock price, various buyers, the currency exposure.
Right.
They're the ones responding to that. We're engaging with our managers who have more of a global macro viewpoint, so they take a look at the world in a big picture sense and trying to harvest some information from them. Right now, it's conversations, and we're trying to determine noise from signal. And candidly, that's an ongoing conversation that we may tilt into the managers we think have a better ability to respond to this, but we're talking very small tilts at this point in time. Right now, it's a lot of noise that we're not responding to.
Right.
Yeah.
And you pick a hypothetical, let's say that there was a tariff on steel from China, would that then you'd say, okay, now maybe U.S. steel companies will therefore prosper? Are you getting into that kind of analysis?
And it goes a lot further than that because, as Ed said, you know, it's not necessarily the individual tariffs, it's the response to the tariff, it's the multilateral response to the tariffs. You know, what does China do? What does the European Union do? How might that, essentially, the range of potential outcomes expands. And the median expected outcome probably shifts downward. So the world's not necessarily operating as well as it could when you're in that environment. Right now, it's a lot of noise.
Sometimes you see those things, they're almost like war games. They say, well, you know, this country attacks that country. Is that basically what Gross is doing? Saying, exactly. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. How long will it take to move to something like Asset Mix 1?
Are you picking that in particular, or are you just saying
they're recommending two, right, Jay?
Or two. I mean, one, two, and three are all
pretty close.
Yeah.
The biggest challenge in terms of timing is the build-out of the private credit program. So our conversations with StepStone on that front, and we do intend to bring StepStone back in for a status update probably early summer. We're looking at about a three-year period to get the private credit fully up to that 12% target at this point in time. The liquid markets, we can obviously be moving on a much quicker time basis. We're fairly close to target in private equity. We're a little bit over target in real estate, but the big piece is going to take that couple years to build out the private credit exposure.
And where is that money going to be in the kind of interim?
It's a combination of U.S. equity and high yield on an interim basis, but we're going to take a look at that and possibly revise that in the phase three implementation resolution that we'll be back in front of the board within a month or so.
And the risk diversifying portfolio, is that close to fully built out? Or
the risk diversifying, the board approved the parametric mandate last meeting. That was $200 million. I think that gets us to 7% total.
Yeah, because you still have the Wellington strategy in there in U.S. and the AFL-CIO.
So that one is probably going to be, I'm trying to remember what was in the memo, 7 or 8%, and just a matter of filling up those last couple percent there.
Right.
Anything else for Tim and Ed? Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you. On to item six.
I'm sorry.
Any reaction to adopt a mixer?
I'm sorry. I thought I read
in your memo.
My memo
says
was
there wasn't
one. Is this information?
No action required.
No action required.
On the sizing of the liquidity program, but on the terms of adopting a target, we still need to do that.
Oh, okay. My apology.
Yeah.
Just leave it up to that.
That's a good point. I don't see it.
Well, we at least need direction about how to draft that resolution. So
Okay.
That's fine.
Sorry.
An action item.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you expect that?
I read that page.
Very short. No, we can have that.
It says no action.
I'm just curious. Yeah. No, it's just a matter of drafting.
Direction
it.
On okay. Mix.
You mean you think like next month? Thank you.
So, what are the board's thoughts on which alt mix is more desirable?
Or to maintain the current long-term target? That's another option.
Does anyone have any thoughts?
What was the staff recommendation?
Alt two.
Mix two.
Yeah.
The suggestion was to go with mix two.
Yes.
That's what I picked up.
I'd be willing to suggest that we give them that direction.
So
not in the form of a motion.
Let's just give them direction to follow with mix two. And
does anyone see where have any objections to that?
I just have a comment. I have to agree with Jay. If you can use this, the same inflation rate and run this model again and see what is the 10-year expected return, that would be great. I think that will be much clearer than right now it's just 6.6, which is lower than the 7%.
We can certainly frame it as a real rate of return.
That's fine too, yeah.
Or at least a footnote. Just
yes,
so
exactly.
So
yes.
People reviewing it can recognize that we're not just saying, yes, pursue this policy. It's nowhere near our rate of return.
So were you wanting just the real rate notated, or did you want that in comparison to the 30-year?
Either way, as long as I make it clear.
As long as it's clear, someone reading and taking a cursory look at this.
That's right.
That we're having an apples-to-apples comparison.
Gotcha.
Right.
Okay.
And how? And again, I think it's helpful because the majority of people don't have the ability to nuance this. You know, I think it's most helpful to have somewhere, whether it's a footnote or directly, the comparison to the assumed rate of return, because people won't, A, know to figure it out that way, or B, they'll just have a cursory glance and say, what is this idiot Cicero board doing? Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, say move forward way below what they anticipate their
what
speak
they for are. Yourself.
You know, I just know where people look when they go through agendas really quickly.
We will clarify that so there's a direct link to the actuary numbers.
As maybe a comparison, CalPERS has had lots written on 6.1 percent being the expected rate of return for the next 10 years by their investment advisors, and 7 to 7.5 being their assumption. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's gotten lots of publicity, and it always looks terrible.
But it does. That's why we want you to make us look better than that.
We will certainly make it clearer.
Okay. Can make us look better.
To John's point, though, and I'm coming from a different point of view, the media is always focusing on I don't call it fake news, but a little piece of it. So sometimes when they say the 6.1, I know that I get other stories on that, just to add to that. Mm-hmm. So, and I get where you're coming from.
Right. And probably just to provide clarity on what the board is actually doing.
Huh? Yeah. The stuff I read sometimes when I see that, it seems like it's almost more opinionated than factual, because then again, I get other articles coming from a different point of view. So I do like the whole transparency, and it's not opinionated, it's more based on what we're doing. Healthier.
Pretty clear on direction.
Yeah.
Great.
Now.